All right, if you've got your Bibles with you, and I hope you do, turn with me to John chapter 11. John chapter 11. And whilst you're doing that, I do apologise if I sound a bit funny today. I think I have caught throat chest thing that's been flying around town at the moment. And I'm on the, hopefully the back end of that. But hopefully that should distract us from what we're looking at today. And parents, there is the kids' room available for you there if you feel you want to avail yourselves of that this morning as well. So John chapter 11, and as you're turning there, just to, for those who haven't been with us, we have been walking through the Gospel of John, and chapter 11 is an amazing chapter. We are looking at what was one of the greatest miracles Jesus ever performed. We saw at the start that his friend Lazarus had died, and Jesus went to go see him and his sisters who were alive and performed something amazing. And now Lazarus had been dead 4 days by the time Jesus got there, which didn't stop him from calling him out of the tomb and raising him from the dead. An extraordinary miracle, and as we said, one that really demonstrates the power that Jesus has, being God, doing something completely unable to be done within a human means or a worldly means. Clearly, this was a divine work. And we come to the latter half of that chapter now. We've seen the miracle happen. And although the last part of this chapter isn't focused on the actual miracle itself in terms of looking at it, it's still very much about that miracle, as we mentioned. And the focus, or the primary focus, is still the same. It's not Lazarus. It's not Mary and Martha. It's actually still Jesus. Jesus is still the focus here. And what we're going to see today is, I guess, the division or the responses, the fallout from this resurrection. And we're going to see people kind of divided into two key groups. There'll be three, but evidently, we will see there's really only two groups. There are many who display faith in Jesus, what he has done. There are some who don't display faith, and rather they display their hostility to the point where they look to kill Jesus. And then there's another group at the end who will display indifference. But we'll see they fit quite firmly into the camp of one of those first two. So without any further ado, let's jump into John chapter 11. We're going to be starting at verse 45 today, and reading through to the end of that chapter. 45. Press my button, there we go. Therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him, but some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Therefore, the chief priests and Pharisees convened a council and were saying, "What are you doing? This man is performing, what are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. Let him go on like this, all men will believe in him. The Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people, and that the whole nation not perish." Now he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into the children of God who were scattered abroad. So from that day on, they planned together to kill him. Therefore, Jesus no longer continued to walk publicly among the Jews, but went away from there to the country near the wilderness, into the city called Ephraim. There he stayed with his disciples. Now the Passover of the Jews was near. Many went up to Jerusalem out of the country before the Passover to purify themselves. So they were seeking for Jesus and were saying to one another as they stood in the temple, "What do you think? That he will not come to the feast at all?" Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was to report it so they might seize him. Now, as we mentioned, or as I mentioned last week, verse 44, the verse before we started today, really is John's curtain call on the event itself, the resurrection. Again, we see today there's no description, there's no narrative revolving around the rising of Lazarus or the events about Lazarus, his sisters, Mary and Martha afterwards. What we see here is stepping into the fallout. But as I said, it's still very much related. And we see that as verse 45 starts with the word, therefore. Very familiar word to us by now through John's Gospel. Therefore, meaning what has just been said, what has just happened, is directly related to what is to come. Because of what has just happened, because of the resurrection of Lazarus, because of the amazing display of Christ's power, raising a dead man to life. This is what happens, John says, and we see we're greeted with some rather good news, aren't we? Well, this is exciting. It says, therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him. I mean, that's incredible news. The question is, why is Mary mentioned and not Martha? The reality is we don't really get a good answer, but what we do see from what John is saying here is the people who have believed are those who came to mourn with them. Remember, John had been saying throughout this whole chapter there were many Jews had come, and most of them, we said, would have come from Jerusalem. Many of them would have been religious leaders. Remember the term he uses for them in the Gospel. And here they came to mourn with these sisters at the loss of their brother, and yet they came and saw something extraordinary. They saw this brother, they saw this man, they saw this friend, they saw him rise from the dead. Undeniable proof that Jesus has in fact divine authority and divine power. They witnessed the miracle, they saw it with their own eyes, and some of them were even involved in the miracle. Remember, Jesus commanded some of them to move the stone away, and others afterwards he commanded to remove the burial cloth off Lazarus when he walked out of the tomb. They weren't just witnesses, some of them, they were directly involved. They touched who was now a living man. They saw, they contemplated with their minds, and they responded in the only appropriate way to respond to Jesus. They believed in him. In fact, John tells us, many believed in him. Now, the term to believe in him is a very simple phrase, but it's a very important one as well. As John has emphasized throughout his gospel so far, saving faith must be placed in Jesus. We must believe in him. It's not just believing about him, but believing in him, in who he is, in whom he claimed to be, that he is the Lord Jesus Christ. He is the Messiah and no other. These men, these people didn't just believe that Jesus had power. These people didn't just believe that Jesus had a connection with God. These people believed in Jesus, that he was God. He was and is the Word made flesh. He is the Messiah. They believed in him. This is wonderful. We've got believers. Now, we've been through John's Gospel, and we've seen on several occasions there are people who have believed, we use inverted commas, but aren't necessarily true believers. They don't have a true saving faith, if you will. We see chapter 2, chapter 6, and chapter 8. All those chapters share occasions where people are of that ilk. However, I think John is very clearly suggesting to us here, or pointing out to us, that these people here in chapter 11, verse 45, are genuine believers. These people have come to a genuine saving faith in Jesus Christ. And there's several reasons for that. One of the first is, I believe, the context we find here clearly indicates that. And not only that, we see there are no words and there are no actions from Jesus to the contrary. In both chapters 2, 6, and 8, we see concerning those superficial believers, Jesus either speaks some words to them, or he responds appropriately in a sense that suggests that you're not actually true believers. You can go back in those chapters and read that. Thirdly, we can see the primary reason, if we remember, for Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead was to glorify God. He mentioned that several times. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 15, Paul tells us that God is glorified when he redeems sinful people to himself. It would make sense then that these would be true believers who'd be saved by God, having seen the power of God and put their faith in him. Not only that, verse 48 indicates that the religious leaders who were in Jerusalem, they saw these people as genuine believers as well, because they saw them as a threat to their hypocritical religious system. Not only that, and probably more importantly, we see John actually contrasts this group in verse 45 with the group in verse 46, who are unbelievers. We'll look at that in a minute. But John consistently and continually throughout his gospel makes contrast between believers and non-believers, and this seems to be a very clear one here. Not only that, this miracle is incredibly powerful. It's very unlikely that such a miracle like this could have produced superficial faith. So I would suggest again that we're looking at genuine believers. So this is a good news. This is exciting. Many people believed in him. As John Calvin says, Christ did not allow this miracle to go without bearing some fruit, for through it some people were drawn to faith. A wonderful thing. I mean, we should celebrate when we read something like that. We should celebrate when we see and hear something like that, as we did this morning. The original Christian convention that happened last weekend. 7 people believed in him. That's a glorious thing, a wonderful thing. 7 lives transformed for all eternity. But of course, as we know, not everyone does. As we've noted throughout this gospel already, Jesus' words and Jesus' actions always seemed to divide. Always seemed to divide. And this particular instance was no different. Jesus himself points that out to us. Luke chapter 12, verse 51. He said, Do not suppose that I have come to grant peace on earth? I tell you no, but rather division. Division. Whenever Jesus is speaking, whenever Jesus is working, whenever Jesus is acting, he caused division. And again, here in this chapter, it's no different. Again, in our day and age today, it's no different either. Could be suggested that some of these people in verse 46 weren't opposed to Jesus. They weren't unbelieving in Jesus. They were just perplexed by what had happened. And so they went to their religious leaders to go and find out what was going on. And some have even suggested that those in verse 46 who did not stay with Jesus but went to the Pharisees and told them the things that Jesus had done, that they were actually going to win over the Pharisees. They thought, wow, you guys missed out. You've got to come and see this. We're going to witness. We're going to evangelize to you. We're going to win you into the faith. And that seems highly unlikely. Again, as I mentioned, John is contrasting these two groups here in these verses. And verse 46 starts with that very small but very important word, but. There it is, but. And but is a particular word that changes the direction. It changes our thought, our focus, from one thing to another. From believers, verse 45, to unbelievers here in this verse. Those who went to the Pharisees to inform them of the things that Jesus had done. Notice they went to the Pharisees. The attitude that these religious leaders had to Jesus was nothing but hostile, and they weren't secretive about it. Those that went to the Pharisees in verse 46 would have known all too well the hatred that these men had for Christ. Thus would be indicative that their intention as well in going to these religious leaders was hostile in itself. Hence, they are unbelievers. They do not believe that Jesus is the Christ. They did not believe in him before the miracle. Probably more surprisingly, they did not believe in him after the miracle as well. One question we might ask is, why is just the Pharisees mentioned in that verse? As we know, there are more than just one group of religious leaders. There's 4 key sects of religious leaders in Israel, and generally John refers to them as the Jews in his gospel. It may have been that the Pharisees had more in common with them, or more contact with the common people, so they were easier to approach. It may have been that there were Pharisees there at the miracle. They were the ones that went back to their own kind, their own group. Whatever it was, either way, we see that this group, these leaders, these Pharisees, were alarmed by the news they heard. I mean, this was the most powerful miracle Jesus had done yet. And that's pretty impressive. I mean, we're talking about a guy that walked on water, that healed a man born blind. And yet this was the most powerful one yet. And they understood the public effect that this was going to have. So they were sparked into action. The Pharisees. Pharisees couldn't act on their own. As I mentioned, there was more than one group of religious leaders in Israel. You see, for action to happen in Israel, they had to get the approval and the vote of the Sanhedrin. And the Pharisees did not have the ruling majority in the Sanhedrin. That belonged to the Sadducees, another group of religious leaders. They had the ruling majority. And so when they got together with the Sadducees, they said, look, we've got to do something. And they convened, it says in verse 47 there, they convened the council, or the Sanhedrin. It's the same thing. Now the Sanhedrin really was the ruling body of Israel. They governed the religious life of Israel, but more than just that, they actually had power and authority over civil affairs and even criminal affairs. They really were the governing body of Israel. The only thing they couldn't do was enact the death penalty, even though it was not forbidden, in fact, instructed in some particular cases in the Old Testament. Rome ruled over the land. They owned the territory. But the Sanhedrin was given the right to look after their own people. And Rome said, you can do everything under your own law except exact the death penalty. That's our job. Only we have the authority to give that order. But think about that next Easter, and you see what the religious leaders condemned Jesus to. They didn't have the authority to do it. Interesting, isn't it? But the Sanhedrin, therefore, had this power and had this authority. And so the Pharisees convened with the Sadducees to have this Sanhedrin decide, let's do something about it. And that's very interesting, because the Pharisees and the Sadducees, although they were both sects, both groups of religious leaders, if you will, they absolutely hated each other. They did not get on at all. They hated each other down to the bone. There were huge differences in the way they went about things, in the things that they taught, the things that they did, the people that they were. There were huge differences in their theology. The Pharisees held to the Old Testament and the law of the rabbis that they had added over and over in the years gone past. The Sadducees, however, rejected all that. They accepted only the Pentateuch, only the books of Moses, the first five books of the Old Testament. The rest they considered as none. The Pharisees believed in resurrection. They believed in angels. The Sadducees rejected both of those things. They didn't believe in resurrection. They didn't believe in angels. The Pharisees were usually made from people from middle-class families. The Sadducees, however, tended to be the wealthy, aristocratic people. They were right up there. They were those that saw themselves as far better, far superior than everyone else, and their wealth and their prosperity proved it in their eyes. They never worked together unless they had to, because of their intense hatred for one another. Yet interestingly here, in the end of chapter 11, we see that both of these groups worked together because they chose to. And why? Because they had a commonality. And unfortunately and sadly to say, the commonality that they had that drove them together was their contempt and their hatred of Jesus. Their contempt and their hatred for Jesus. They were not meeting to discuss the clearly divine act that had just taken place. A dead man has been risen from the grave. They're not meeting to talk about that. They were not meeting to discuss the fact that clearly the Messiah is present. The one that we have been waiting for is here. And we're not meeting to talk about what they should do and how they should instruct the people to go and see and go and listen to Jesus. The resurrection of Lazarus that Jesus had stated was for the glory of God. We see in many coming to faith in Jesus, it brought glory to God. Yet the religious leaders were meeting and convening a council to find out how they could suppress that glory and hide it from the people. They were trying to figure out how they could get rid of Jesus, how they could stop what he was doing. What are we doing? They asked themselves. Oh. We've been sitting on our hands. What's been going on? This guy's been continuing doing all these amazing things. And what have we done to stop it? Evidently not much. Jesus is becoming very popular. As they point out, for this man is performing many signs. He's performing many signs. It's really interesting that the issue at hand was not that Jesus was performing miracles. Although they point out he's doing it, that wasn't the issue. Right? The issue was that he was becoming a threat to their power, their influence, and their position. He was going to put that all in jeopardy, and he already was, and that was a big problem for them. The real issue they bring up in the next verse, verse 48. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But what I want you to have a look here is something very interesting. It's been brought up throughout the Gospel so far, and we've talked about it already. But these men here are a great little analogy, a great little visual illustration of the wickedness of the human condition, of the total depravity of the sinful state of men. The natural fallen state of people is nothing but totally wretched, totally devoid of righteousness, and totally and utterly unable to please God. Sounds pretty sad, doesn't it? But that's the reality of what the scriptures teach. And here we have that in its epitome as a great example. I mean, these men here have even admitted amongst themselves that Jesus is performing these signs. Jesus did these things. He healed that blind man. He rose that guy from the dead. He did that. And he's performing many signs. Not just two, not just three, heaps of them. I mean, many of these blokes here, these religious leaders, saw a lot of these signs. They've seen them with their own eyes, just as the men at the tomb would have seen. They knew Jesus was doing things that were clearly the divine power of God, the divine work of God. They understood what was going on, yet they still rejected him. They still rejected him, despite the overwhelming evidence that Jesus is in fact who he claimed to be, despite the overwhelming evidence that he is in fact the Word made flesh. He is the God-man, because he did what only God can do, and he continued to do what only God can do. Despite all that, they still rejected it, seeing it, knowing it, understanding it. And thus we see the state of the sinful nature, completely devoid of pleasing God in itself whatsoever. Just before I go on here, I want to bring up as well, it's easy for us, maybe just me, but I know it's easy for me, to sit here and go, well, that's them. I mean, those guys, they were a real bunch of idiots. I mean, they were as dull as they could be. They had Jesus there in front of them. They saw what he did, and still, well, that's them. You can put that on them, but you can't put that on me. I'm not that bad. And I even find it easy in our world today to look around and find people that are far worse than me, and thus justify that I'm actually not that bad off. The reality is, sin, all sin, is completely and utterly devoid of good. Thus, the sinful state of everybody, being born into sin, as Paul said, for no one is righteous. There is no one who seeks after God, no one who has understanding, none. Everyone without Christ is in this same predicament. Completely devoid of hope, completely devoid of power to change things. They have no capacity to believe. They have no desire to believe. That is the state of these men here. They are the great epitome of it. I mean, that's why Jesus told some of them in chapter 10, verse 44. Oh, sorry, that's why Jesus told us in chapter 6, verse 44, rather. No man can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him. Because you are completely unable to come to me in your own power. You need my power. You need me. You need God to intervene. Even for you to believe in me. Reminds us that miracles alone will not convert anyone's soul. Facts and evidence and proof alone is not enough to convert anyone's soul. The soul needs, what the heart needs, is God's grace and God's Holy Spirit. Miracles and facts and evidence are useful, but it's only God who will change a heart. Thus, again, we're reminded that salvation only comes through divine initiative and divine intervention. Salvation is a gift of grace that comes from God. And the reality is, if it weren't for God, if it weren't for His grace, I actually would be no different from these men here, convening a council to find out how they can suppress the glory of God that they have no capacity to submit to and no desire to submit to. Verse 48, we see why they wanted to get rid of Jesus so badly. If we let it go on like this, that is, if we let him go on healing the blind, healing the sick, giving the deaf hearing, if we let him go on raising the dead, if we let him go on demonstrating his clear divine power, proving himself to be the Messiah, if we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. See, these men, they didn't want to lose what they had. They didn't want to give up what they had. They had it good. They had it made. They had everything where they wanted it. Things were going pretty well for them. They had possession. They had power. They had prestige. They had influence. They had their self-righteous and self-serving religious system. They had it going. And they were worried because when Jesus came, he challenged the status quo. He challenged their status quo. And he revealed the hypocritical religious system for what it was. And people were starting to follow him. He comes, the Romans will come. If we let him go, if we continue to let him do this, the Romans will come and they'll take away both our place. The place they're referring to is most likely the temple. The temple was their symbolic place of power, of prestige. It was their turf. That's what gave them their power, their rule and authority, was the temple. So they thought, the Romans will come and take our place, our temple, and they'll come and take our nation as well. They officially own the nation of Israel, but what they mean is they'll take us as the Jewish people away. They'll destroy us, they'll take us into exile, they'll take us out of our land. The danger was real for them. And it was even more real because the Passover was coming. You see that in verse 55, it was very near. And that meant Jerusalem was going to be full of zealous Jewish people. If the Romans got whiff that an uprising was possible, they would come into town and they would crush it. And absolutely destroy them. Wreck their system. Take them out of their position. Take away their possession. Take away their power, their authority, their influence. Take everything they had from them. Exactly what they didn't want to happen. The great irony here is the very thing that they feared would happen by leaving Jesus alone is actually exactly what happened when they pushed in their ignorance and their determination to stop him. You see, they eventually caught Jesus, they eventually murdered Jesus, crucified him, and as we know, he rose from the grave. And some 30-odd years later, the Romans in fact did come in. They did destroy Jerusalem. They burned down the temple when they took the Jews into exile. The very thing they feared is exactly what happened. Yet they thought if they exerted themselves, that somehow they could hold Christ's progress, that somehow they could hold what Christ was doing. They had absolutely no understanding that Christ doesn't work to his own timetable, and Christ wasn't doing his own thing. He was serving the Father. He was working to God's plan. There was nothing they could do to halt it. In fact, they became participators in it. Incredible. So, they're a little bit unsure what to do. They know why they want to get rid of Jesus. They know why they want to stop him. But there's a bit of ambiguity as what to do around there. And then their leader speaks up with a radical and a very sinister plan. Verse 49. Caiaphas, John says, was the high priest that year. Now we're going to see Caiaphas again as we continue through the Gospel of John. But the high priest is not an annual position. It might sound like that the way John has said it. But theoretically, the high priest was a lifelong position. Back in the Old Testament, God commanded that those with a high priest that they would become high priests, and once they become high priests, they stayed there until they died. Then the next person would take that place. But in first century Israel, Rome ruled over the land, as we mentioned, and they would frequently remove high priests if they displeased them. And so thus what John is saying here is Caiaphas was the high priest at that point in time. In fact, if you go and look at history, Caiaphas was the high priest for quite a bit of time. It goes to show the great political sway that he had and the ruthlessness of the man as well. But he was seemingly frustrated with the indecision of the council here. And so in verse 49, at the end of it, he speaks up, and he starts very interestingly, "You know nothing at all." I mean, that's not a good way to win friends and influence people, is it? "You know nothing at all." I'm not sure how many of you would listen to me if I got up there and started my sermons with that. And again, you go back and look through history, you'll see it's actually apparently typical, the rude behavior of those Sadducees. Thus was the position, thus was the high rankingness that they felt they had over everyone. And again, the relation they had with the Pharisees. "You know nothing at all." He goes on, verse 50. "Nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people, and that the whole nation not perish." He's suggesting here it's better for us to kill one man and let the whole nation be destroyed. Either Jesus dies or Israel dies. We need to make a decision. And for them, the decision's pretty easy, right? I mean, the point he's making is a pretty simple one. But John points out to us something very interesting here. The fact is, what Caiaphas was saying is, blasphemous, as callous as it was, sinister as it was actually also prophetic. It was also prophetic. He says in the next verse, verse 51, he did not say this on his own initiative. You see, Caiaphas spoke what was actually going to take place. Unwittingly. I mean, he wasn't a puppet. He wasn't God pulling strings of him and moving his tongue as he willed without his knowledge or without his understanding or without his will. Caiaphas spoke exactly what he thought. Caiaphas spoke exactly what he intended, and he is responsible for his own words, his wicked words and his own wicked intent. But God sovereignly and God providentially infused into the words that Caiaphas spoke meaning that he did not intend. John effectively tells us that Caiaphas prophesied it without even knowing it. He spoke what he believed, but a higher impulse guided what he said. And it's quite appropriate, really, when you think about it, because what was the office that he held? The high priest. He was it. He was God's spokesman at the time, or he was meant to be anyway, the title. And Caiaphas unwittingly spoke of the sacrificial death of Jesus for the nation of Israel. God turned the blasphemous and wicked intentions and words of this man into truth. That Jesus would die for the nation of Israel. And unlike Caiaphas, God had a bigger scope. God had a wider scope. And John reminds us of that in verse 52, that he would not just die for the nation of Israel. He says, not for the nation only, which means he will die for Israel, but not just for Israel, but also those that he might gather together, but in order that he might gather together into one children of God who are scattered abroad. Jesus didn't come just for Israel. Jesus came for the Gentiles as well. Jesus came for all his sheep. As he said in the previous chapter, "I have other sheep who are not of this fold, and I must bring them also. They will hear my voice, and they will become one flock with one shepherd." Caiaphas prophesied at the sacrificial death of Jesus for all who are God's, for all who will believe in him, that he would die for them, take upon himself their price, their punishment for their sin. They need not bear that before God anymore. Amazing. Out of the mouth of an incredibly wicked man, God still speaks. Having heard their leader share this, and having shared in his murderous intentions, we see these religious leaders, well, they agree with him, don't they? In verse 53, we read a quite a solemn, short but solemn verse. So from that day on, they planned together to kill him. They agreed. They agreed together. They planned together. And can I remind you yet again, the Sadducees and the Pharisees hated each other. Yet here they are agreeing and planning together. Why? Because they had a commonality and it was hatred. Absolute hatred and rejection of Christ. Folks, this is the outcome. This is the fruit of all sin. You may not think, people may not think they're as bad as someone else. My sin's not as bad as someone else. But the reality is, all sin is the trajectory of hatred towards God and rejection of God. That's why we need Christ so bad. That's why we needed Christ to die for us, to intervene and save us and bring us to Him. And thus their decision here to kill Christ was part of God's plan, but it's also interesting, it was already made before they even arrested Him. Weeks before they arrested him. Weeks before the illegal trials they had of him. Which means that whole system, the whole night before he was crucified, where he goes through those trials, was a complete mockery. Because they'd already passed sentence before any of that happened. It's not justice. It's not justice at all. Jesus responds, not with words, but with actions. Verse 54, he no longer continued to walk publicly among the Jews. He was aware of the Sanhedrin's decision, so he moved out of the way. Again, we see he's completely in control of his situation. He would not be taken before his appointed time that the Father had set. And so, we see, as we've mentioned over the last few weeks, Jesus' public ministry is now coming to an end. This chapter here, chapter 11, is that bridging between his public ministry and his private ministry. Now, having risen Lazarus and having the Sanhedrin melded together and on a very clear and focused intent to kill him yet again, but they're all on board this time, and Jesus goes into his public ministry, focusing on his disciples and preparing them for his coming crucifixion and his coming resurrection and the job that they will do thereafter. And in the end of the chapter, John tells us that the Passover was near. This is the third and final Passover mentioned in John's Gospel, which means Christ's death is near. The Passover, by the way, required Jewish pilgrims to come into Jerusalem, come and present themselves before God. Hence, there would have been a lot of people coming to Jerusalem, and hence we see in verse 55, people coming from out of the country. Some were coming early to purify themselves. Great irony, isn't it? The people are coming into town to purify themselves while their religious leaders soil themselves with murderous intentions to kill God incarnate. Interesting thing though is these crowds, most of which wouldn't have seen the resurrection of Lazarus, most of which, all of which would not have been involved in the Sanhedrin's decision, they obviously understand that Jesus is sought after by the religious leaders. They've put out the word, the order, if anyone knows where he is, to tell them so they can go and seize him. Their intent is clear. It's clear to them and it's clear to the people. And if these people that are coming in have an interest in Jesus, they're talking about, do you think he'll come? He probably won't come to the feast this time because they're after him, aren't they? Do you think he'll make it or not? They're looking intently and they have an interest, but the reality is they have no commitment. And again, we're going to see that as we continue through this gospel. These are going to be the very same people who, in a short space of time, are going to be shouting and praising him as the Messiah as he rides in on a donkey. And then only a few days later, they're going to be shouting to Pontius Pilate, crucify him. The very same people. Their fickle devotion proved that their hearts were actually just as hard as their religious leaders that were hell-bent on killing Christ. Resurrection of Lazarus forced people into a decision. Forced them into a decision they need to make about Christ. Again, we see that there are only two options. Either you believe in Christ through his grace, through saving faith,
Or you reject it, which is every other option, even indifference. As I mentioned, and as we'll see, as Passover draws near, it wasn't long for those who were indifferent, those who were hostile, banded together to crucify the Son of God, the Lord of glory. As Christ said to Martha only last week, "Did I not say to you, if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" Speaking of the raising of her dead brother, if you believe, not only will you see a dead man raised, but not only will you see an amazing, powerful miracle, you will see the glory of God. So I believe wholeheartedly, Christ says that to us too. You believe, you will see the glory of God. Not just an amazing Easter story of a man rising from the dead, having been crucified, but you will see the very Son of God, the God of glory, and the glory of the risen Lord in what it is, in who he is. And you will see it for who he is. Folks, there's really only one of two options. Believe in him, or just like these religious leaders here, reject it with a hostile intent. Everything else